my youth, I was a drunk man, just mumbling tones. It's 04, so of course I'm still stumbling home. Probably 30 drinks in me, keg beers and whiskey, plus the cocaine. My eyes is like lights in the city. High light, but you could die right there in the streets over that bullshit. Similar to what you call beat. What is life? How does it grow? Where does it go? How would you know if I told you so? Autopilot, switched on with brain all silent. Your back of me bathed in ultraviolet rays. Your body living decays. Cold world got you crumbling. You're drifting away. It isn't a game. Kid, in real life it never is. Everybody dies. Almost everybody never lives. That's why I never question why I catch the bad luck. Cause all that bullshit I did, I know it add up. That's why I never question why the odds against me. That's why the devil's tempt me. Jealous once and I am a tiger. Head full of wickedness. I used to move death around in the streets with no witnesses. I was the thing that went bump in the night. A soldier psycho, make love to your soul with a knife. Unfortunate, but it seems that's who I was at that point. 40 ounce of rum, half eight ball, a fat joint. My life was flashpoint through criminals' eyes. 365, put your hands up, reach for the sky, yo. That's why I never question why I catch the bad luck. Cause all that bullshit I did, I know it add up. That's why I never question why the odds against me. That's why the
what's up, motherfuckers? Welcome back to Black Hoodie Alchemy. I'm your host, Anthony Tyler. We're broadcasting here on the Fringe FM initially. Thank you for joining me. Recently, we brought up C.S. Lewis, the Christian philosopher and fictional writer as well. You know, Chronicles of Narnia and all that jazz. But he's also a really interesting philosopher and very Christian. Some of which I certainly disagree with. For lack of a better term, a lot of the points are taken too esoterically for my taste. They're too on the nose, and I think that there's a more esoteric, multifaceted interpretation. And that I think that, you know, just too much Christianity today just takes too literally. And while C.S. Lewis does have an esoteric touch to him, he seems to be caught somewhere in the middle. And as I mentioned last time we brought him up, he seemed pigeonholed by certain social limitations, I think, that he didn't want to transgress. He didn't really want to push the envelope too much, but he was no stranger to it. And that's something we're going to be talking about today. We brought up the problem of pain last, and this ties into it quite a bit. It's a book that was actually dedicated to J.R.R. Tolkien himself. It is a series of letters. It's called the Screwtape Letters, and it's a series of fictional letters of an administrative. He plays an administrative coaching role, but, you know, for lack of a better term, he's a strong journeyman demon in the active working ranks in the bureaucracy of hell. So he's working for the Dark Lord. And he is, through letters, training, and it seems like a fairly formal apprenticeship, his nephew, Wormwood. There's some cool demon names in here. All the lore is in the background, but it's good. It serves its purpose uniquely in that way. I almost feel like it would have been cooler to really expand upon the actual fictional demonology in here. And who am I kidding? It probably would have been super cool. But the fact that he didn't and he just dibble-dabbled in it is pretty cool. You know, it sort of leaves you to fill in the blanks and it makes it fun. Some of the other names of the demons in here are Scab Tree, Trip Tweez, Slub Gob, Globos, Toadpipe, and my favorite, I think, Slum Trippet. So that's pretty cool. I like that. And yeah, this came out in the early 40s. I want to say 1942. I'm pretty certain of that. And World War II lasted from 39 to 45. Yes. So this book was written and published initially all while World War II was happening. And that's heavily referenced in the work. You could see potentially how this whole idea, if written today, could be taken to a metaphysical horror novel. It's really not that. It's actually very mundane. You know, there's no gore. There's nothing like that. The things that Screwtape is coaching Wormwood on have to do with, you know, lack of faith, the vices, you know, the seven deadly sins, finding, you know, and social exchanges, essentially. But that doesn't make it any less interesting. And it's not that long either, so it's not too time consuming. And there's, you know, if someone is the more rebellious type and pretty disinterested in Christianity, you might find some of the Christianization of this work to be tiresome. But we're doing this all from a Jungian perspective. I invite you to listen to the last episode where we talked about C.S. Lewis and the episode on Carl Jung's answer to Job, as well as, you know, A Trail of Breadcrumbs. All of this is every time we mention God and we get into God or goddess, we're building off of what we've talked about. So feel free to, you know, pick up the Trail of Breadcrumbs. There is plenty of additional material. But suffice it to say, I think that fewest words possible, God is the manifestation of reality, and goddess is what that manifestation springs from. It's like the difference between the egg itself and the hatching of the egg. God is more so an action principle. Certainly not your traditional man in the sky, not as far as our conversations are concerned. So I'm going to get into this a little bit, but I guess before we go any further, you know, check out the link tree where you can get my books, Dive Manual, Empirical Investigations of Mysticism, and Hunt Manual, 21st Century Demonology, and Fortiana. If you are interested by the Screwtape letters, I definitely encourage you to check out my book, Hunt Manual. It's not the same at all, but I was definitely one of the dozens of little pieces of inspiration for that book was the tone of the Screwtape letters, how it was really like letters to the shadow complex, the Jungian shadow complex. And in that sense, Hunt Manual is very similar. And what I said about how I wished the Screwtape letters took it further, I took it very far. So check it out. Check out the Patreon action that we got coming soon in the show notes, Existential Alchemy in Practice. I'm very excited to have that out. So you can go and check that out. It's going to be once a week, $5 a month. So you're going to get plenty of content, and we're going to get a lot more personal and intimate with the pursuit of alchemy in that series. So, you know, and rate the show, review the show if you've been listening and you haven't yet. It helps. You know, if you like what you hear, support somehow. I greatly appreciate it. All right, let's move on. And this is essentially, like I said, just a series of letters. There's no communication from Wormwood. It's all Screwtape. And they're meant to be snapshots of moments. So I'll give you the basic gist without spoiling it. But we have the trials and tribulations of a young man that Wormwood is trying to break down and claim the immortal soul of with the aid of his uncle Screwtape. And this man basically put out just in the explanation of the principles, really, but, you know, for clarity, the young man is growing up, you know, it's social things, and then he gets worried about being drafted into the war. He's a European of potentially English, but it's never strictly said, I don't believe. In fact, I think there's some geography referenced where it would have to be somewhere like Poland or something along those lines, an inner European country, but it's not important at all. And then he becomes, you know, he falls in love with a woman meanwhile, and the war rages on. I won't spoil it for you, but the end is a banger, most certainly. And this whole book, it's like, it's passively intense, because it's all snapshots in letters, but the material itself is pretty thought-provoking. Very meta, I guess you could say. In any case, even if I don't agree with the literalizations of hell, I think it's a very real allegory. I think that we should all be, you know, take heed. But I don't think it's an afterlife that we're stuck in. I think we could find a lot more truth in the Buddhist concepts of hell, where we might be temporarily stuck in them in the afterlife even. Who knows? I don't completely discount hell. You know, addicts on the street are going through hell right now. Need I say more, really? So here we go. Here's the letters. I have a summary, a collage of quotes. We're certainly not going through the whole thing, though. I note what you say about guiding your patient's reading and taking care that he sees a good deal of his materialist friend. But are you not a trifle naive? It sounds as if you supposed that argument was the way to keep him out of the enemy's clutches. Remember, the enemy here is God. That might have been so if he had lived a few centuries earlier. At that time, the humans still knew pretty well when a thing was proved and when it was not. And if it was proved, they really believed it. They still connected thinking with doing and were prepared to alter their way of life as the result of a chain of reasoning. But what with the weekly press and other such weapons, we have largely altered that. Your man has become accustomed, ever since he was a boy, to half a dozen incompatible philosophies dancing about together inside his head. He doesn't think of doctrines as primarily true or false, but as academic or practical, outworn or contemporary, conventional or ruthless. Jargon, not argument, is your best ally in keeping him from the church. And again, I am not a Christian. I feel like I am not in overt disagreement with Christianity. I just have an esoteric take on it. But Christianity, part of what makes you a Christian is believing that everyone else is wrong. And that's one of the main reasons I couldn't call myself a Christian, even an esoteric one, truthfully, is because I don't believe that everyone else is wrong. I think there's a lot of comparative takeaways. Not everything's the same, but there's a tapestry here. But I think if you replace the church with the path, you know, the proper path, the path to enlightenment, the path of the Tao, you know, I think it plays very well. So anyway, onward. Don't waste time trying to make him think that materialism is true. Make him think it is strong or stark or courageous. That is the philosophy of the future. That's the sort of thing he cares about. The trouble about argument is that it moves the whole struggle onto the enemy's ground. He can argue too, whereas in really practical propaganda of the kind I am suggesting, he has been shown for centuries to be greatly inferior of our Father below. He is in God. By the very act of arguing, you awake the patient's reason. And once it is awake, who can foresee the result? Even if a particular train of thought can be twisted so as to end in our favor, you will find that you have been strengthening in your patient the fatal habit of attending to universal issues and withdrawing his attention from the stream of immediate sense experiences. Your business is to fix his attention on the stream. Teach him to call it real life and don't let him ask what he means by real. Above all, do not attempt to use science, I mean the real sciences, as a defense against Christianity. They will positively encourage him to think about realities he can't touch and see. There have been sad cases among the modern physicists. If he must dabble in science, keep him on economics and sociology. Don't let him get away from that invaluable quote-unquote real life. But the best of all is to let him read no science, but to give him a grand general idea that he knows it all and that everything he happens to have picked up in his casual talk and reading is the result of modern investigation. Actually, one of our greatest allies at present is the church itself. Do not misunderstand me. I do not mean the church as we see her, spread, but through all time and space and rooted in eternity, terrible as an army with banners. That, I confess, is a spectacle which makes our boldest tempters uneasy. But fortunately, it is quite invisible to these humans. All your patient sees is the half-finished, sham Gothic erection on the new building estate. When he goes inside, he sees the local grocer, with rather an oily expression on his face, bustling up to offer him one shiny little book containing a liturgy which neither of them understands, and one shabby little book containing corrupt texts of a number of religious lyrics, mostly bad and in very small print. When he gets to his pew and looks round, he sees just that selection of his neighbors whom he has hitherto avoided. Work hard then on the disappointment or anticlimax, which is certainly coming to the patient during his first weeks as a churchman. The enemy allows this disappointment to occur on the threshold of every human endeavor. Underline that. It occurs when the boy, who has been enchanted in the nursery by stories from the Odyssey, buckles down to really learn Greek. It occurs when lovers have gotten married and begin the real task of learning to live together. In every department of life, it marks the transition from dreaming aspiration to laborious doing. It is a little bit disappointing to expect a detailed report on your work and here for narrative note, a lot of times it wouldn't matter, but it's starting a new point, and this is the beginning of a new letter. It is a little bit disappointing to expect a detailed report on your work and to receive instead such a vague rhapsody as your last letter. You say you are delirious with joy because the European humans have started another war of theirs. I see very well what has happened to you. You are not delirious, you are only drunk. Reading between the lines in your very unbalanced account of the patient's sleepless night, I can reconstruct your state of mind fairly accurately. For the first time in your career, you have tasted that wine which is the reward of all our labors, the anguish and bewilderment of a human soul, and it has gone to your head. I can hardly blame you. I do not expect old heads on young shoulders. Did the patient respond to some of your terror pictures of the future? Did you work in some good self-pitying glances at the happy past? Some fine thrills in the pit of his stomach, were they? You played your violin prettily, did you? Well, well, it's all very natural, but do remember, Wormwood, that duty comes before pleasure. If any present self-indulgence on your part leads to the ultimate loss of the prey, you will be left eternally thirsting for that draught of which you are now so much enjoying your first sip. If, on the other hand, by steady and cool-headed application, here and now you can finally secure his soul, he will be yours forever. A brimful living chalice of despair and horror and astonishment, which you can raise to your lips as often as you please. An important spiritual law is here involved. I have explained that you can weaken his prayers by diverting his attention from the enemy himself to his own state of mind about the enemy, focusing on the light and not what is making the light. On the other hand, fear becomes easier to master when the patient's mind is diverted from the thing feared to the fear itself, considered as a present and undesirable state of his own mind. And when he regards the fear as his appointed cross, he will inevitably think of it as a state of mind. One can therefore formulate the general rule: in all activities of mind which favor our cause, encourage the patient to be unself-conscious and to concentrate on the object. But in all activities favorable to the enemy, bend his mind back on itself. Let an insult or a woman's body so fix his attention outward that he does not reflect, "I am now entering into the state called anger or the state called lust." Contrarywise, let the reflection, "My feelings are now growing more devout or more charitable," so fix his attention inward that he no longer looks beyond himself to see our enemy or his own neighbors. Think of your man as a series of concentric circles, his will being the innermost, his intellect coming next, and finally, his fantasy. You can hardly hope at once to exclude from all the circles everything that smells of the enemy, but you must keep on shoving all the virtues outward till they are finally located in the circle of fantasy, and all the desirable qualities inward into the will. It is only insofar as they reach the will and are there embodied in habits that the virtues are really fatal to us. All sorts of virtues painted in the fantasy or approved by the intellect or even in some measure loved and admired will not keep a man from our Father's house. Indeed, they make him more amusing when he gets there. And I added this next line in here because I thought it was funny. This is, these are some of C.S. Lewis's pitfalls. Like, really, you think that hippie pagans are going to hell? Like, come on, man. Come on, man. That's really the God you want to worship? I don't buy it. I don't think that's even really what it says in the long run. I don't think that's what Christianity's about. I think that here, I've said this before, but let me say this again. At best, from a more actually intellectual point of view, you can say that the supposition that any religion is right and others are wrong, you can say that wrong doesn't mean that they're going to burn in hell. You know, you could get more interpretive with hell, and you can say that being right means the most pro-adaptive. You know, if there's a continuum of religion, and Christianity is one of the more recent ones, and it's lasted so long, there might be a case for its pro-adaptive nature. I'm not saying that wholeheartedly, but I do see the pro-adaptive quality. I just don't think it's the end-all be-all. Some people would suggest that, though, and you know, at least it's actually interesting food for thought instead of just I'm right and you're wrong. So I can at least understand that, but like, it doesn't make any sense for me to have well-intended people going to hell. But reincarnation makes a lot more sense. There's chaos theory involved. There's a lot of theoretical physics that makes sense with it. And wouldn't it be punishment enough to have to start over if you failed? It seems to make logic. It actually makes sense to me. But here is what C.S. Lewis says. Makes me laugh a little. If once we can produce our perfect work, the materialist magician, the man not using but veritably worshiping what he vaguely calls forces while denying the existence of spirits, then the end of the war will be in sight. And fair enough, I do think that there is a danger in over-psychologizing these things. I think psychology is where it begins. From our vantage point, that's where we can understand the trail of breadcrumbs, but who knows where it ends. Continuing. I had not forgotten my promise to consider whether we should make the patient an extreme patriot or an extreme pacifist. All extremes, except extreme devotion to the enemy, are to be encouraged. Not always, of course, but at this period. Some ages are lukewarm and complacent, and then it is our business to soothe them yet faster asleep. Other ages, of which the present is one, are unbalanced and prone to faction, and it is our business to inflame them. It is no good at all in inflaming his hatred of Germans if, at the same time, a pernicious habit of charity is growing up between him and his mother, his employer, and the man he meets in the train. Humans are amphibians, half spirit and half animal. The enemy's determination to produce such a revolting hybrid was one of the things that determined our father to withdraw his support from him. As spirits, they belong to the eternal world, but as animals, they inhabit time. This means that while their spirit has been directed to an eternal object, their bodies, passions, and imaginations are in continual change, for to be in time means to change. Their nearest approach to constancy, therefore, is undulation. The repeated return to a level from which they repeatedly fall back, a series of troughs and peaks. If you had watched your patient carefully, you would have seen this undulation in every department of his life, his interest in his work, his affection for his friends, his physical appetites, all go up and down. As long as he lives on earth, periods of emotional and bodily richness and liveliness will alternate with periods of numbness and poverty. The dryness and dullness through which your patient is now going are not, as you fondly suppose, your workmanship. They are merely a natural phenomenon which will do us no good unless you make good use of it. Never forget that when we are dealing with any pleasure in it, in its healthy and normal and satisfying form, we are in a sense on the enemy's ground. I know we have won many a soul through pleasure. All the same, it is his invention, not ours. He made the pleasures. All our research so far has not enabled us to produce one. All we can do is to encourage the humans to take pleasure which our enemy has produced at times or in ways or in degrees which he has forbidden. Hence, we always try to work away from the natural condition of any pleasure to that in which is least natural, least redolent of its maker, and least pleasurable. An ever-increasing craving for an ever-diminishing pleasure is the formula. It is more certain, and it's better style. to get the man's soul and give him nothing in return. That is what really gladdens our father's heart. And the troughs are the time for the beginning of the process. Another possibility is that of direct attack on his faith. When you have caused him to assume that the trough is permanent, can you not persuade him that his religious phase is just going to die away like all his previous phases? Of course, there is no conceivable way of getting by reason from the proposition, I am losing interest in this, to the proposition, this is false. But as I said before, it is jargon, not reason, you must rely on. The mere word phase will very likely do the trick. I assume that the creature has been through several of them before, they all have, and that he always feels superior and patronizing to the ones he has emerged from, not because he has really criticized them, but simply because they are in the past. You see the idea? Keep his mind off the plain antithesis between true and false. Nice, shadowy expressions. It was a phase. I've been through all that. Oh, and don't forget about the word adolescent. And here is a bit of a change in tone where Uncle Screwtape is further reprimanding the young Wormwood as we see progress throughout the book. On your own showing, you first of all allowed the patient to read a book he really enjoyed because he enjoyed it and not in order to make clever remarks about it to his new friends. In the second place, you allowed him to walk down to the old mill and have tea there, a walk through country that he really likes, something he took alone. In other words, you allowed him two real positive pleasures. Were you so ignorant as to not see the danger of this? I love the idea of a demon being so pissed at this. A good book and tea outside. The characteristics of pain and pleasure is that they are unmistakably real and therefore, as far as they go, give the man who feels them a touchstone of reality. Thus, if you had been trying to damn your man by the romantic method, by making him a kind of, fancy boy, references I don't understand, submerged in self-pity for imaginary distresses, you would try to protect him at all costs from any real pain. Because, of course, 5 minutes' genuine toothache would reveal the romantic sorrows for the nonsense they were and unmask your whole stratagem. But you were trying to damn your patient by the world. That is, by palming off vanity, bustle, irony, and expensive tedium as pleasures. How can you have failed to see that a real pleasure was the last thing you ought to have let him meet? Remember always that he really likes the little vermin. He, as in God, and sets an absurd value on the distinctness of every one of them. When he talks of their losing their selves, he only means abandoning the clamor of self-will. Once they have done that, he really gives them back all their personality and boasts, I am afraid sincerely, that when they are wholly his, they will be more themselves than ever. Hence, while he is delighted to see them sacrificing even their innocent wills to his, he hates to see them drifting away from their own nature for any other reason. Your patient has become humble. You have drawn his attention to the fact. And I think that's a good time to get into a commercial break. Stick with me, folks. We are reading through the Screwtape Letters by C.S. Lewis, a book dedicated to J.R.R. Tolkien himself. This is Black Hoodie Alchemy. I'm Anthony Tyler. Spiritual we'll be right back. We need love to kill the bullhead.
Yeah. Times of war, spit of bloodshed to kill them all. Bloody knives sticking out the kitchen wall. Head spinning pistol brawls in broad daylight. Bloody sunsets on Christmas Eve, it's all love. Forgotten like First Nations histories. It's all blood, sweat and mysteries. Tears of war left frozen in the winter's breeze. Kiss your sister's cheeks, Mother Earth still. Smile upon the children of the humble dirt. Stumble work a million lives to torture life. Fuck it hurts, fuck the church. Colonize the serfs without seeing worth. We grow and build, overthrow the masters with a soldier's will. Uphold the scales through these battlefields of Babylon, the urban stencil, just a place to raise the cattle on. Running with shackles on through hell's decathlons. Blood in the castle lawn, beheading the average pawn. The savage strong, bend the bows when the arrow's long. Put it proper, peep the penny pinch from the pharaoh's pawn.
The spirit makes the man worships the mirror. Mirror reflects the eagle singing the hymn of injustice. Spiritual warfare. We need love to kill the war.
Howdy do, everybody. That's right, it's me, good old Tippy Patson here. And I got some great dang old news, man. With the new year, I am, in fact, going to become the spiritual mentor for NFL quarterback Aaron Rodgers. And I tried to reach out through the interwebs, and we got a hold of him. I'm going out to New York, and, you know, dang old man, it just feels good to have a win. It was an interesting year, 2023, but we had some tough times. As you know, we've lost many of our recruits. But don't worry, the League of Extraordinary Gents ain't going nowhere. We're just trying to expand our dang old horizons. And speaking of dang old horizons in the new year, a lot of people doing that old New Year's resolutions and whatnot. Well, don't forget Tippy Patson's Rainbow Body Weight Loss Program, you know, with a month's worth at a time of Colombian cocaine paste called Bazooko. But also, you know, there's a lot of great old tips and tricks. So keep this in mind for your New Year's resolution. If you're, you know, if you're trying to do more cardio, you know, just start smoking more cigarettes. That's what a lot of doctors won't tell you, okay? But smoking cigarettes, it raises your blood pressure and makes your heart beat fast. So, you know, it's basically the same thing as cardio. Also, you know, yeah, have you ever, like, accidentally, you know, cooked like a real hot meal and then put some aluminum foil on it? And noticed that dang old aluminum was melting. You know, a lot of doctors will tell you that ain't no good. But Tippy Patson is here to tell you that some aluminum shavings in your coffee every day will keep the doctor away. You know, it's just as good for you as zinc or iron or all them metals. So, you know, you could do that. It's an ancient Chinese remedy, I do believe. And lastly, just keep in mind, you can't have too much blood. You know, so the serial killer Richard Chase, he was always trying to get blood in him, and he did it in the wrong ways, but he had the right idea, I tell you what, boy. So, you know, just get a bunch of blood and just start putting that inside you. You know, the more virile you are, the more, like, gasoline, like blood, you know, metaphorically your body had to work with, and you'll be, you know, all the better for it. You know, these are all the tips I'm going to give Aaron, but, you know, I can't give away all my secrets on the radio. So, you know, just get a little bit in there for now, you know. I hope y'all have a good new year and stick to your dang old resolutions and, you know, put some of my tips into effect. Tippy Patson is out of here for now, folks. We'll keep you updated on my travels. All right, take it easy.
Hello, everybody. It is I, Jefferson Tillamook Slinger, former Illuminati cloning lab manager and current member of the League of Extraordinary Gents. You know, as you've heard, Tippy Patson is going to the Big Apple, so I will be holding down the fort here in the Everglades, and I've been thinking this is probably a very good time for, like, a rebranding type thing, and I've recently sobered up using Bazooko with the Tippy Patson Rainbow Body Weight Loss Program, high five, and, you know, I've been thinking, like, you know, I need to just reinvent myself. I've had a lot of dumb names. I know Tillamook Slinger. But so I got to come up with something sleek. So I was thinking Jeff Mamba. Yeah, Jeff Mamba. Like, because I've been watching a lot of Chris Angel Mind Freak lately. And Jeff Mamba, Chris Angel, kind of have, like, had a similar thing going on. But so I was thinking, like, Jeff Mamba, Mind Master. But, and that might be a good one. But I don't know for sure. You know, I'm clearly going to be a master. So maybe I should be a little more descriptive. Like, I could be like Jeff Mamba, mind jockey. You know, like a horse jockey, except for your mind. Or I could be like Jeff Mamba, mind surfer. Because I surf the waves of your mind. I don't know. Oh, but I think I'm on the right track. If you want to give me some ideas or tell me which one is your favorite, go ahead and contact Joseph Rupert of the Fringe FM's Lighting the Void. I'll give you his personal cell phone number. It's 779-2011-1952-9. Write that down. Okay, Jeff Mamba holding it down in the Everglades for the League of Extraordinary Gents. And I am out of here. What is up, Protendos? It is I, Muscle Tornado. You know, I've just, you may know me as a super fit DMT numerologist explorationer and, you know, member of the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. But I've been going through, I've had a lot of casualties lately, and, you know, my hand is gone. I have a hook now. I've lost my hair, I think due to the stress. I lost my eye recently. And unfortunately, recently, I was violently savaged by piranhas in the water. And my leg is gone. So, you know, I have like a thigh nub. But other than that, I'm doing great. I'm doing really good, guys. I haven't really been smoking a lot of DMT lately, but I've been keeping strong with the insufflation of the pixie stick, and it's been a good time, you know. So, I just started wearing a pirate hat because I figured I should just embrace it right now. I'm not really sure the whole pirate code is, because unfortunately we lost our cosmic ghost pirate because I accidentally changed the channel on him. He was just stuck in the TV, and so the only one that could have really understood my plight, now that I've come to terms with it, is gone. So, you know, but I do have a cool peg leg now. That's pretty sweet. So, you know, we're just going to rock it. I'm going to put a lot of bedazzlements and jewels on it. And, you know, we'll have a good time. So, but yeah, Tippy Patson's leaving. So, you know, it's just going to be me and Jeff Mamba. So. We're gonna see what the future holds, guys. You know, take it sleazy, and Muscle Tornado is over and out.
Not violent, yes you are. You're as violent as they come. I know this because I'm as violent as they come.
Spit acid to the mic burns, then tell the crowd I'm about to take it back. Like platforms and chop sideburns, then I proceed to stunt mud holes on bitch MCs. Crush their chest and seize their abilities to breathe. Ayo, DJ, spin that machete blade while I drop the fat shit on all these rap heavyweights. Blast your habitat, madness, savage rap. My battle tracks is like Chernobyl's aftermath. No escaping, mutilation, mutation on the world politic and through your news and music station. Muse is changing, building lessons that never stop, and now it's on like Parkers when the weather drop. Prophetic thoughts fill my page with these deadly darts. A heavy cost, your life's paid if you step across. Heaven is not far away if you test the style that you now. Bare knuckles with no weapons.
This hits
out.
A rapper in the face, make them see stars via trip through the clouds and to Venus and Mars. Like a greyhound bus with the weight, suckers losing heads like they're unlucky Timothy.
Welcome back to Black Hoodie Alchemy, folks. We are still talking about demonology, the fucking screw tape letters, getting inside the minds of demons, trying to get inside the minds of humans. Weird shit. I love it. It's the bread and butter kind of content for this show. So let's just keep going at it. Don't forget to check out the show description and get on my Linktree action. All right. Your patient has become humble. Have you drawn his attention to the fact all virtues are less formidable to us once the man is aware that he has them? But this is especially true of humility. Catch him at the moment when he is really poor in spirit and smuggle into his mind the gratifying reflection, "By Jove, I'm being humble," and almost immediately pride at his own humility will appear. If he awakes to the danger and tries to smother this new form of pride, make him proud of his attempt. And so on, through as many stages as you please. But don't try to do this too long, for fear you awake his sense of humor and proportion, in which case he will merely laugh at you and go to bed. I feel like I've been there. I'm sure the humility thing. I've been beaten down enough. I feel like I am genuinely humble, but I've been there about going through the loop of being neurotic in a variety of ways, tiring yourself out so much that eventually all the worry just loses meaning. It all just genuinely looks crazy. And you just kind of have to realize that's something you got to work on. Haven't felt like that in a long time, thankfully. The whole looping thing, that sucks. And I feel for you if your brain gets away from you in that way. There is a way to calm it, though. It takes time. Here we go. Keeping it going here. You must therefore conceal from the patient the true end of humility. Let him think of it not as self-forgetfulness, but as a certain kind of opinion, namely a low opinion, of his own talents and character. Some talents, I gather, he really has. Fix in his mind the idea that humility consists in trying to believe those talents to be less valuable than he believes them to be. No doubt they are in fact less valuable than he believes, but that is not the point. The great thing is to make him value an opinion for some quality other than truth, thus introducing an element of dishonesty and make-believe into the heart of what otherwise threatens to become a virtue. By this method, thousands of humans have been brought to think that humility means pretty women trying to believe they are ugly and clever men trying to believe they are fools. And since they are trying to believe, and since what they are trying to believe may in some cases be manifest nonsense, they cannot succeed in believing it, and we have the chance of keeping their minds endlessly revolving on themselves in an effort to achieve the impossible. Yeah, wow, damn. Lying to yourself is not humility. Our business is to get them away from the eternal. Our business is to get them away from the eternal and from the present. With this in view, we sometimes tempt a human, say a widow or a scholar, to live in the past. But this is of limited value, for they have some real knowledge of the past, and it has a detriment. It has a determinate nature, and to that extent resembles eternity. It is far better to make them live in the future. Biological necessity makes all their passions point in that direction already. So that thought about the future inflames hope and fear. Also, it is unknown to them. So that in making them think about it, we make them think of unrealities. In a word, the future is, of all things, the thing least like eternity. It is the most completely temporal part of time, for the past is frozen and no longer flows, and the present is all lit up with eternal rays. As long as that is the real course of his tranquility will do us good, because it is only piling up more disappointment and therefore more impatience. For him, when his false hopes are dashed, if he is aware that horrors may be in store for him and is praying for the virtues wherewith to meet them, and meanwhile concerning himself with the present because there and there alone all duty, all grace, all knowledge, and all pleasure dwell, his state is very undesirable and should be attacked at once. Here again, our philological arm has done good work. Try the word complacency on him. But of course, it is most likely that he is living in the present for none of these reasons, but simply because his health is good and he is enjoying his work. The phenomenon would then be merely natural. All the same, I should break it up if I were you. No natural phenomenon is really in our favor. And anyway, why should the creature be happy? The enemy's demand on humans takes the form of a dilemma. Either complete abstinence or unmitigated monogamy. Here's the Christianization again. But I mean, in general theory, you know, I think it's good. The idea, I think, like the general takeaway is keep with one partner. Like if you're trying to take subjective morality out of it, I think there's a lot to be said about that. I mean, hey, I've been one to enjoy myself and sleep around a little bit. You know, I think most people have at least a little bit. Even the ones that are super devout, they got it out of their system and then they became devout. Either that or they've been devout the whole time and they're, you know, slowly plotting the murder of their children. So a lot of that shit goes. Most of the time, people feel really fucking self-righteous because they got that all out of their system, which is a whole lot different than never doing it and not becoming some sort of fucking pervert, because repressing yourself is one of the biggest sins. You know, that's how we get a lot, so many cases, more often than any other case, we get horrific serial killers and brutal crimes because people repress their sexuality, and then it starts to ooze out Oh, bad metaphor. It starts to slip through the cracks in ways that just become bare bones, animalistic, violent. And it, you know, it happens more often than not from religious suppression. So don't buy that line of bullshit. But should we be, you know, should we be classy people when we date each other? Yes, absolutely. And I think that, you know, well, you shouldn't get too hung up on, you know, someone, you know, live in the moment a little bit for your relationships. You know, sometimes the future can trip you up, like he was just talking about there. But, you know, I think probably date with in mind, like who you might want to spend the majority of your time with, right? I think it's always a bad idea to date someone you dislike because it's easy or fun. So again, for the sake of the explanation, we have complete abstinence or unmitigated monogamy. Ever since our father's first great victory, we have rendered the former very difficult to them. The latter, for the last few centuries, we have been closing as a way of escape. I find this part interesting. We have done this through the poets and novelists by persuading the humans that a curious and usually short-lived experience, which they call being in love, is the only respectable ground for marriage. That marriage can and ought to render this excitement permanent, and that a marriage which does not do so is no longer binding. This idea is our parody of an idea that came from the enemy. The whole, and I think that that's such a great point, you know. Finding someone to spend the rest of your life with, you know, I'm not an expert. I feel like I'm fully convinced I found that person, but I'm not an expert. I'm still young. All the people that seem to have it together say that you have to be best friends with them, right? Because the sheer romance, if you're relying on the sheer romance itself to constantly be ablaze, then you're always going to be disappointed. That being said, if you're not able to stoke the flame continuously, then that's an issue. All right, hell. Here we go, hell. The whole philosophy of hell rests on recognition of the axiom that one thing is not another thing, and especially that oneself is not another self. Huh. My good is my good, and your good is yours. What one gains, another loses. Even an inanimate object is what it is by excluding all other objects from the space it occupies. If it expands, it does so by thrusting other objects aside or by absorbing them. A self does the same. The error is easy to produce because being in love does very often in Western Europe precede marriages, which are made in obedience to the enemy's designs, that is, with the intention of fidelity, fertility, and goodwill. Just as religious emotion very often, but not always, attends conversion. You complain that I do not make it clear whether I regard being in love as a desirable state for a human or not. But really, Wormwood, that is the sort of question one expects them to ask. Leave them to discuss it. Leave them to discuss whether love or patriotism or celibacy or candles on altars or teetotalism or education are good or bad. Can't you see there's no answer? Nothing matters at all except the tendencies of a given state of mind in given circumstances to move a particular patient at a particular moment nearer to the enemy or nearer to us. Thus, it would be quite a good thing to make the patient decide that love is good or bad. If he is an arrogant man with a contempt for the body really based on delicacy but mistaken by him for purity, and one who takes pleasure in flouting what most of his fellows approve, by all means let him decide against love. Men are not angered by mere misfortune, but by misfortune conceived as injury. And the sense of injury depends on the feeling that a legitimate claim has been denied. The more claims on life, therefore, that your patient can be induced to make, the more often he will feel injured as a result, ill-tempered. Now you will have noticed that nothing throws him into a passion so easily as to find a tract of time which he reckoned on having at his own disposal unexpectedly taken from him. In terms of their daily habits, work on their horror of the same old thing. I can relate to this. I mean, not like I can't relate to a little bit of all of this, like any human, but the horror of the same old thing resonates with me. The horror of the same old thing is one of the most valuable passions we have produced in the human heart, an endless source of heresies in religion, folly in counsel, infidelity in marriage, and inconstancy in friendship. The humans live in time and experience reality successively. To experience much of it, therefore, they must experience many different things. In other words, they must experience change, and since they need change, the enemy, being a hedonist at heart, has made change pleasurable to them, just as he has made eating pleasurable. But since he does not wish them to make change any more than eating, an end in itself, he has balanced the love of change in them by a love of permanence. He has contrived to gratify both tastes together on the very world he has made, by that union of change and permanence, which we call rhythm. He gives them the seasons, each season different, yet every year the same, so that spring is always felt as a novelty, yet always the recurrence of an immemorial theme. He gives them in his church a spiritual ear. They change from a fast to a feast, but is the same feast as before. The only constructive passage in your recent letters is that where you say that you are still expecting good results from the patient's fatigue. That is well enough, but it won't fall into your hands. Fatigue can produce extreme gentleness and quiet of mind, and even something like vision. If you have often seen men led by it into anger, malice, and impatience, that is because those men have had efficient tempers. The paradoxical thing is that modern fatigue is a better soil for peevishness than absolute exhaustion. This depends partly on physical causes, but partly on something else. It is not fatigue simply as such that produces the anger, but unexpected demands on a man already tired. Whatever men expected, they soon come to think they have a right to. The sense of disappointment can, with very little skill on our part, be turned into a sense of injury. It is after men have given into the irremediable, after they have despaired of relief and ceased to think even a half hour ahead, that the dangers of humbled and gentle weariness begin. To produce the best results from the patient's fatigue, therefore, you must feed him with false hopes, put into his mind plausible reasons for believing that the air raid will not be repeated. Keep him comforting himself with the thought of how much he will enjoy his bed next night. Exaggerate his weariness by making him think it will soon be over, for men usually feel that a strain could have been endured no longer at the very moment when it is ending, or when they think it is ending. In this, as in the problem of cowardice, the thing to avoid is the total commitment. And here we get closer to the end. Uncle Screwtape laments that you have let this soul slip through your fingers, Wormwood. The howl of sharpened famine for that loss re-echoes at this moment through all the levels of the kingdom of noise down to the very throne itself. It makes me mad to think of it. How well I know what happened at the instant when they snatched him from you. There was a sudden clearing of his eyes as he saw you for the first time and recognized the part you had in him and knew that you had it no longer. Just think, and let it be the beginning of your agony, what he felt at that moment, as if a scab had fallen from an old sore, as if he were emerging from a hideous, shell-like disease, as if he were shuffled off for good and all a defiled, wet, clinging garment. By hell, it is misery enough to see them in their mortal days taking off dirtied and uncomfortable clothes and splashing in hot water and giving little grunts of pleasure, stretching their eased limbs. What then of this final stripping, this complete cleansing? The more one thinks about it, the worse it becomes. He got through so easily. No gradual misgivings, no doctor's sentence, no nursing homes, no operating theater, no false hopes of life, sheer instantaneous liberation. One moment it seemed to be all our world. The screams of bombs, the fall of houses, the stink and taste of high explosive on the lips and in the lungs, the feet burning with weariness, the heart cold with horrors, the brain reeling, the legs aching. Next moment, all this was gone. Gone like a bad dream, never again to be of any account. Defeated, outmaneuvered, fool. Did you mark how naturally, as if he'd been born for it, the earthborn vermin entered the new life? How all his doubts became, in the twinkling of an eye, ridiculous? I know what the creature was saying to itself. Yes, of course. It was always like this. All horrors have followed the same course, getting worse and worse and forcing you into a kind of bottleneck, till, at the very moment when you thought you must be crushed, behold, you were out of the narrows and all was suddenly well. The extraction hurt more and more, and then the tooth was out. The dream became a nightmare, and then you woke. You die and die, and then you are beyond death. How could I have ever doubted it? And that's it for the Screwtape Letters, folks. An eerie read, huh? I encourage you to read the entire thing. It's always stuck with me throughout the years. And, you know, I tried my best to clean house as we went along, so I don't have a whole lot in summary. Other than reiterations to come, you know, the little nuggets that we've talked about in all the episodes about God and Goddess, and, you know, this culmination of this continuous, you know, investigation into, I don't know, the crossroads between psychology and the divine. And I hope you dug it. I hope you got some interesting food for thought out of it. And I hope you tune in next week. Don't forget to follow up on some of the other action I got out there, whether it be books or anything else. And, yeah, fucking A. It's been Black Hoodie Alchemy. I'm Anthony Tyler.
Man, scientist.
Hopefully, God bless.
Yo, memory fragments. Compliment these sublime melodies, accents when true rhymes shine. A nuance grind, lab table, supine spine. Pulling monumentally gas out of you mong's mind. Strong hallucinogenics, liquid imbued with intelligence that ooze in the sentence. Putrid and hellish, Fukushima nucleus remnants. This shit is like those fucking acid trips the youth would embellish. What else is hidden in this man's mind? You couldn't tell it, it's lucid, angelic, and devilish. Suited with menacing runes full of bullets and skeletons. Tunics and relics, I even found a random leather boot and bruise for the fellas. It's fucking filthy. God damn, it fucking fills me with dread. Just to look in his head, it fucking kills me. It still thrills me, I probe further. The flow certified murder, couple knives and a chrome burner, half-eaten corpses, maggots, roaches spinning on the broken record as the wax decomposes. Where? The walls closing in, I see a dark figure, a ghost holding a pen. I approach closest him.
Table of contents, my hidden chambers are boxed in. The gift of simulation is godsend, cause reality sucks. And I'm here to sniff the vapors from toxins. You don't dare to strip the waste of a locksmith. The odor of a primitive stink, and all the criminal beings goes to death breathing invisible ink. Speaking subliminal riddles, each of a minimal schemes. Evil as rivers that ripple, wreaking the chemical leaks. I catch victims at the most vulnerable state. Postpone the decay, put the suicide notes on the delay. I promise them the most fortunate date in the most cordial of ways. All you do is sign your soul over to me. After your broad strokes on the page, I swing a long sword at your face, then restitch your torso to your waist. And when niggas make an eye contact, make their minds go black, alter their physical life on wax, and find abusive Cenobites on crack, who try to chew the seven mics on hands, find solutions in the Lysol can. My mind's a music tune device on blast, a black Rubik's Cube despite all man. From the womb where evil sparks, flesh and bone made from demon parts, I take a bite at your beating heart, feed the mob, follow hexagon until your meat dissolves. Meet the god, I steam enough smoke to make the ceiling cough.